is Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we just got back from that mHealth Summit in Washington, D.C., and what a great conference that was. It was a blue ribbon panel, Bill Gates, Anisha Chopra, Ted Turner, Judith Rodin, and really thinking about ways to discuss the ways that mobile technology can increase access, efficiency, and effectiveness in the health systems in both the developed and the developing world. One thing I was really struck by is that the developing world is much further advanced than the developed world when it comes to mobile technology.
And also, I was struck by just how many people there were from all over the world at the conference. I think over 2,500 participants. But when I think it was Bill Gates asked people to raise their hand if they were from outside the United States, from the front to the back of the room, hands went up from all corners of the globe. So I think you're right. The density of cellular telephone usage around the country has certainly contributed to that. But also, people aren't dealing with some of the legacy of our systems here in the United States. I did have the sense, though, a lot of this is still garage phase, didn't you? I think we frequently heard not ready for prime time on some of them, difficulty reaching to scale, but a tremendous sense of enthusiasm and innovation. And I think we're going to see enormous development in this area over the next year or two.
I think you're right, but it's a big garage. There are 5 billion cellular phones out there in the world, and there were a lot of people working on that transformation. And really, in the developing world, it's about delivering access to healthcare. And really, in the developed world, it's about improving efficiencies, seemed to be the dividing line. But you're right, we're still kicking the tires. And we all want to keep our eye on the mHealth Alliance, which was one of the sponsors, along with the Foundation for NIH and NIH as well. So we really had, I mentioned just a few of the people who were there, but it was a long list of very talented people, innovators, entrepreneurs, researchers from all parts of the globe.
And one thing we've heard a lot about in the last couple of months, we heard from Melinda Gates not too long ago, was the work of the United Nations around the Millennium Development Goals and those big goals to significantly reduce poverty, maternal child death, to improve education for women and girls across the world. And we saw some of that reflected in the big progress that has been made around controlling infection, reducing infant mortality rates, and reducing the number of children who die before they reach their first birthday. And you know, I couldn't help thinking, looking at the newspaper and the cholera outbreak in Haiti, we know that mobile health's one of its biggest impact has been in the area of surveilling for the spread of infectious diseases and trying to get an early jump on them. And I'm sure that's being used right now, and we hope we'll have some good results in controlling that epidemic.
We certainly do. And this week, we're looking forward to having a conversation with Dr. Andrew Morris-Singer, who's president and founder of the Primary Care Progress, a group he founded while in medical school at Harvard that's been working to engage clinicians, trainees, and students in their local primary health communities with the ultimate goal of expanding the primary care workforce. We're happy he can join us today.
And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes and get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of a show, come visit us at chcradio.com. You can also become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Andrew Morris-Singer, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. President Obama defended the health care law after House Democrats lost their majority to Republicans in last week's midterm elections. Told of exit polls showing that 1 in 2 voters would like to see the law overturned, the president countered by saying that it also means 1 out of 2 voters think it was the right thing to do. The president said he expects the issue of repeal to come up in discussions with Republican leaders going forward, and he says he's willing to listen if Republicans have ideas for making changes to the health care bill.
There are going to be examples where I think, you know, we can tweak and make improvements on the progress that we've made. That's true for any significant piece of legislation.
Not up for discussion, however, are provisions in the Patient's Bill of Rights, such as guaranteeing that people with pre-existing medical conditions are not denied health insurance. The Department of Health followed in step by announcing that it will offer new plans with cheaper premiums in the 24 federally run state pools recently set up for people with pre-existing medical conditions. HHS will lower premiums by about 20% in 2011 and offer different plan options to those enrolled in the new pre-existing condition insurance plan. The temporary program, which ends in 2014 when insurers will no longer be able to discriminate based on a person's health status, has only 8,000 enrollees since it opened on July 1st. HHS hopes the lower premiums will attract more enrollees to the program. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that as many as 4 million uninsured Americans are eligible and that 200,000 would be enrolled by 2013. A new report issued by the Department of Health estimates that under the new health law, average savings for those enrolled in traditional Medicare will amount to more than $3,500 over the next 10 years. Savings will be even higher, as much as $12,000 over the same 10-year period, for seniors and people with disabilities who have high prescription drug costs. The department also wants to remind seniors that Medicare enrollment begins November 15th. The annual enrollment period, which closes December 31st, allows beneficiaries to make changes to an existing plan or to choose a different plan. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a long-shot request for a review of the Obama administration's health care overhaul before the matter has been fully litigated. The High Court's rejection of the health care challenge was brought by a conservative legal group in California.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Andrew Morris-Singer, president and founder of Primary Care Progress, a group that seeks to grow the primary healthcare workforce and engage clinicians, trainees, and students in their local primary healthcare communities. Welcome, Andrew. You're a graduate of Harvard Medical School and now a practicing primary care provider at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. You founded the Harvard Primary Care Working Group in 2009. In order to engage the Harvard medical community to help transform primary health care training at Harvard, this later became Primary Care Progress. Many would say that institutions like Harvard Medical have moved away from a focus on training primary care providers. After all, Boston is the medical mecca of the world. What drew you to primary care, and what was the inspiration for establishing Primary Care Progress?
When I was training, the primary care providers that I worked with were really some of the most committed, passionate, and inspirational people that I came in contact with. And pretty quickly, I realized that that was sort of my community that I wanted to be a part of. And I also had a pretty harrowing experience as a medical student when I almost lost my mother to a very severe infection that really had gotten out of control because she had a lack of access to primary care, and everything turned out okay. But it was a really moving experience that helped me understand, how important primary care is. And then finally, towards the latter years of my training, it just became clear that primary care is a field that's reinventing itself. That, you know, there are inspiring providers all over the place who are really transforming how they provide care. And I saw that and realized that primary care would be a wonderful field that I could really carve out a really fulfilling career. And so that was really what drew me into primary care, kind of a no-brainer for me. And in terms of Primary Care Progress, the inspiration was really around engaging members of the primary care community to come together in local communities around collaborative activities that revitalize the local primary care community. And as you mentioned, we came together at Harvard Medical School around this issue of the defunding of the Division of Primary Care. That's what spurred us on there. But pretty quickly, we realized that communities all across the country, primary care communities, were hungry for similar opportunities, similar activities And that's really what Primary Care Progress is all about, bringing people together to engage local communities to revitalize primary health care.
And Andrew, I think you're with the wave in the country around the renewed focus on primary care. And Harvard University itself just took another big step forward in this arena, right with the announcement of the new Center for Primary Care, funded by a $30 million gift. And that's to support primary care through new educational programs and innovative research looking at both the way primary care providers are paid and the way they deliver care. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how your group contributed or was involved with the formation of the center, which I understand is due to open next year.
Sure. The center is incredibly exciting for our community. And I think it comes out of, 16 months of the Harvard primary care community coming together in an unprecedented way. Our group Primary Care Progress really played a pretty critical role in that. When the division was initially defunded, there were many in the community who sort of saw that as the sort of final nail in the coffin of Harvard primary care. But there were many of us who saw it really as an opportunity to bring together residents, medical students, faculty who are passionate about primary care to really harness their perspectives, their passion, and bring that together in a dialogue that could really help Harvard reimagine its primary care focus. And we had a series of town halls, petitions. We worked collaboratively with the dean's office, and I think that this new center represents the sort of product of that collaboration. So we're incredibly excited by it and think it's going to have really transformative potential both locally as well as hopefully nationally.
We will all keep an eye on it. Part of the mission statement for Primary Care Progress says that the central premise of PCP is that of addressing the challenges facing primary health care requires a grassroots, bottom-up approach, that the next generation of primary health care clinicians has a critical role to play in this transformation. Tell us exactly what those challenges are, and to what extent does the transformation of primary care now underway, team-based, patient-centered medical homes, use of electronic health records, bode well for primary care?
So, it's interesting. People talk a lot about the challenges facing primary care, and there are a number of things. We have the imbalance between supply and demand of services. There's an increasing demand for services. There's a decreasing supply as, fewer and fewer physicians are choosing to stay in practice. Fewer and fewer medical students have been choosing to go into primary care. We also have a dysfunctional payment system that really drives a lot of these problems. So primary care providers have been paid less. Many of the things that they do are not compensated. Medical students see this, and they haven't been as enthusiastic about going into the field. So there are a number of challenges. One of the biggest is this issue of the pipeline. And what we've found is that we don't actually have to recruit people into primary care, because what we know is that huge numbers of medical students actually show up to medical school on day one, very interested in being primary care providers, very curious about it. Maybe they were, encouraged to become a doctor by a family member who's a primary care provider or their own doctor. So they want to be primary care providers. And what we know happens at medical school quite frequently is they get discouraged. They have bad experiences. They have bad shadowing experiences. They're not exposed to the exciting things going on. So we know that a huge thing that we have to do is get these folks exposed to the exciting things going on in primary care and the exciting people doing those things. And that's one of the fundamental principles of Primary Care Progress, that we actually think that by getting these trainees engaged and involved is going to be one of the best ways to get them to, enter the field. And we actually think that they have a number of skills to contribute to help accelerate the transformation of primary care as it exists right now.
And that sentiment is certainly echoed by the Harvard Medical School Dean. It's Dr. Flyer, right, who has said that the center's overarching goal will be to change how the primary care profession is viewed by medical students. And as you say, many are initially interested and then end up choosing specialty. And he went on to say that the shift takes place right as the country begins to implement the health reform that relies so heavily on a better primary care system, both to improve quality and contain costs. We note you have good company in New England with the Dartmouth Medical School and the work they're doing with the Dartmouth Center for Healthcare Delivery Science, which is also focused on innovations in quality and delivery. Harvard, Dartmouth, is this enough to suggest a trend across the country? Are you collaborating with other partners nationally to advance your mission?
Absolutely. Primary Care Progress is reaching out to all of the different national and local community groups that are really trying to promote primary care and revitalize the community. I think the bottom line is, you know, we've had medical advances, biomedical advances, for years, and that's really been the forefront pushing forward, our healthcare system. And unfortunately, though, we have not had a parallel, advance in how we deliver services. So, you know, we've got robotic surgery these days, but we also have 50% of diabetics not receiving the recommended care that we've known for decades saves lives. And I think more and more individuals and institutions are starting to understand that we need parallel advances in how we deliver care, in how we organize care. And I think academic medical institutions are also starting to understand that they really have an important role and opportunity here to really transform how providers are trained. And I think that the Dartmouth Institute, as well as this new Center for Primary Care at Harvard, are real clear indications of that. And I'm hoping that we're going to see similar changes across the country.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Andrew Morris-Singer, president and founder of Primary Care Progress. Andrew, a big part of your mission at Primary Care Progress is engaging trainees in clinical innovation. I read about a medical student at Brown University who began working with a health center to improve patient care and clinic flow. He changed patient management at the clinic by using a shared Google Doc to make it easy for staff and providers to communicate in real time. So how do you encourage innovation through your organization? And can you give us some examples of how you've done this in your own community?
Absolutely. And I think that story is a wonderful, wonderful example of the concrete change that a medical student can be involved in. I mean, when I was a medical student, you know, we would go into practices, and this wasn't that long ago, mind you. We'd go into practices, we'd sit there and quote-unquote shadow the provider. They would, you know, they would be treating a patient, we would watch, maybe we would say a few things, and, you know, that would sort of be that. But I think these new opportunities for students are far more engaging and far more productive, where they're actually taking part in transforming a small piece of the delivery system in that particular clinic. And trainees who, you know, are now looking at these opportunities and saying, hey, you know, I might not be able to manage diabetes as a first-year medical student, but I can come to your clinic and I can help you rethink, you know, the way the nurse practitioners, interact on the phone with the hypertensive patients, or, you know, the way your community health care worker, organizes his or her time to better meet the needs of patients. And we're starting to see that more and more locally as well as nationally. And what our group is trying to do is help individuals and communities set up these collaboratives, these student faculty clinical innovation collaboratives, to pair students and faculty together to create and implement similar projects.
So Andrew, you really speak eloquently to the energy and the passion, the commitment and the interest that young medical students have in primary care, all of which I would agree with you completely on. Where the rubber often meets the road is in the issue of payments and reimbursements once people are in practice. And the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act really try to address some of that. What are your thoughts on how successful those interventions will be? And they range from paying primary care providers more under Medicare and Medicaid and to accountable care organizations and other strategies, but what's your thought on whether that's going to really accomplish what it needs to?
We have an incredible challenge right now where the primary care system in our country has been completely, you know, devitalized, through years of neglect in many ways. And we have a number of challenges like we've talked about. And I think the solution to this, the way we're going to remedy it, is really going to be a multifaceted approach. We need reimbursement reform. We need innovation grants to really encourage local providers and support them in their efforts to redesign care. We need to support the creation of more primary care training programs and create loan forgiveness for those people who are training. So I think many of these provisions are absolutely critical. We also need patients to have access to insurance, because without access to insurance, they're not going to be able to get access to primary care. At the same time, though, we think that, many of these conversations about payment and about, what the government's role in regulating, basically managing the system, have kind of overshadowed some other important conversations about what do we actually want care to look like and how do we train providers to prepare them to actually deliver this care. And that's what Primary Care Progress is really focused on. We're focused on ensuring that, we can actually provide the care that patients need in a manner that works for providers.
Andrew, we like to ask all of our guests this question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversation be keeping an eye on?
There are a ton of people doing really exciting stuff. And people have probably heard some of these names like Geisinger, Group Health, the Greenleaf practice in the South. I mean, these are folks who are really at the forefront of transforming care delivery to meet the needs of patients and providers alike. So those are definitely systems that are going to teach us a lot, I think. At the same time, though, I think it's important for listeners to understand that innovations are taking place literally in a clinic around the corner for them. And there are providers who are really recommitting to, transforming their care to better meet the needs of patients. And so, I think it's very important for us to look at these practices that are doing huge change and huge transformation. But, there are providers all around the country who are doing small, subtle things that are having really profound implications for their patients. And those people need our encouragement as well. They need us to spotlight what they're doing. And, in many cases, they need help. And that's one of the things we're hoping to do is get trainees engaged with those local providers so that they can learn from the experience, they can get energized, and they can also, really contribute to transforming care to better meet the needs of patients and providers.
Well, you're making a great contribution to the next generation. Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Morris-Singer, the president and the founder of Primary Care Progress. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on Chop Chop, a nonprofit quarterly food magazine that aims to fight obesity by promoting nutritional literacy and cooking skills to children. Sally Sampson, a longtime cookbook author and food writer, created Chop Chop in early 2010. Inspired by her many hospital visits with her chronically ill daughter, Sampson was eager to make more of a difference with her writing and saw the obesity crisis as an area in which she could help. Sampson envisioned giving pediatricians recipe cards to pass out to their patients during well-child visits to help children and their parents learn about healthy cooking. All of the doctors she approached eagerly agreed to distribute the recipes. Many told her the written information would serve as a valuable resource when they talked about nutrition with their patients. Chop Chop quickly expanded to a full 32-page magazine format, riding a wave of growing enthusiasm for the project. In a matter of months, Sampson secured sponsorship and support from all over the nutrition advocacy world. This past spring, Chop Chop sold over 150,000 copies of its first edition, whose contents include 11 recipes, cooking tips, explanations of kitchen tools, a food-related word game, and an interview with a 12-year-old Orin Fox, a young local food activist. All content is designed for and reviewed by 5 to 12-year-olds. While Samson initially expected to distribute Chop Chop only through pediatricians, the magazine's reach has expanded to encompass grocery stores, after-school programs, farmers markets, and schools, including the entire Somerville, Massachusetts public school district. Samson says her ultimate goal is to put the magazine in the hands of all 28 million school-age children in the United States. Interested listeners can visit chopchopmag.com for more information. By making nutritional information entertaining and empowering children to cook healthy food, Chop Chop magazine is helping to reverse the trend of childhood obesity one recipe at a time. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.